analyzed an outbreak during the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, we found that for every extra person who identified an individual as a friend, that well-liked individual was prone to get the flu 8 days earlier in the course of the epidemic. This means that in Figure 7, B would get infected roughly 16 days earlier than A, because B has two more friends than A. But this also means that popular people are more likely to become immune early on in the course of an epidemic. And if all the popular people became immune early, relatively more paths for the virus to spread through society would be cut off. Unpopular people are less concerning from an epidemic control point of view because they intrinsically infect fewer other people, so their immunity matters less. This also means, incidentally, that vaccinating people with many connections is more helpful than vaccinating people with few connections. Finally, the environment may facilitate superspreading events, such as a SARS-2 outbreak in a choir in Washington State in March 2020. The act of singing involves the expulsion of air at high force, which likely contributes to spread. In this case, an infected person was part of a group of 61 singers who were in a densely packed area for 2.5 hours. As many as 52 of them caught the virus from the index case. 3 of them were hospitalized, and 2 of them died. An analysis in South Korea showed that outbreaks were more common in Zumba classes than Pilates classes for a similar reason. Heavy, rapid, deep breathing or shouting may be a risk factor for transmission, whereas slow, gentle breathing is not. But being indoors itself plays an important role. Other superspreading events have involved the assembly of large numbers of people in indoor environments. At a funeral in Georgia on February 29, 2020, someone spread the virus to 200 other people, which accelerated the broader epidemic in that state. Something similar happened at a February meeting in Boston, involving executives of a biotech firm. Dozens of people became infected. And there have been superspreading outbreaks in prisons, nursing homes, hospitals, factories, and other indoor places where people are densely packed. A study of 318 outbreaks of 3 or more cases in China in the early days of the pandemic found that all but one of them took place indoors. One of the positive implications of the existence of superspreading events is that if people or environments prone to superspreading can be identified, infection control efforts can be targeted, possibly leading to large gains in both efficacy and efficiency. We do not necessarily need to stop all social interactions. We can focus on tightly packed conventions and nightclubs, for instance, and we can move religious or other events outside or online. For one more comparison, let's very briefly consider the second deadly coronavirus epidemic prior to this one, MERS, which stands for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. MERS first appeared in 2012 and has symptoms that are very similar to the two SARS pandemics. As of 2020, there have been only 2,500 cases worldwide. Most of the cases, 80%, have occurred in Saudi Arabia, though the disease has cropped up in 26 other countries, almost always in people who have traveled to the Middle East. This disease also originated in bats, but the intermediate host is camels, who apparently acquired the virus some decades ago. Contact with an infected camel, or camel products, can lead to infection, as can substantial contact with an infected person. The estimated CFR for MERS is 35%, which makes it about 3 times as deadly as SARS-1. But the R-naught is low. Human-to-human transmission is not easy. Most cases are among intimate household contacts or healthcare workers caring for an infected patient. Several studies have suggested that the R-naught of MERS is actually approximately 1.0 or even below, though other studies estimated the R-naught to be on the order of 2.0 to 2.8. As we have already learned, such a low value would be below the epidemic threshold, since an R-naught of 1 means that each patient transmits the virus to only one new person, effectively making it impossible for an epidemic to grow in size. From this review of basic epidemiological parameters, we can see that, compared to SARS-1 in 2003, SARS-2 in 2020 has intrinsic features that make it much more of a threat. Most estimates place the R-naught of SARS-2 as roughly the same as that of SARS-1, about 3.0. This is actually rather worrisomely high for a pathogen. Compare it to the R-naught of ordinary influenza, which is 0.9 to 2.1. But SARS-2 has a smaller dispersion in R sub E, meaning that transmission chains are somewhat less likely to be dead ends, which makes it easier to reliably spread SARS-2 than SARS-1. SARS-2 is also less deadly than SARS-1, with a CFR of less than 1% compared to around 10% for SARS-2. As we saw, this makes SARS-2 paradoxically more concerning because larger numbers of people survive and move about for longer to transmit it. Finally, and perhaps most important, unlike SARS-1, SARS-2 has a positive mismatch period. This allows for asymptomatic transmission and makes traditional public health responses based on detection and quarantine very difficult. The upshot of all these factors is that there is a very high probability that SARS-2 will infect a large percentage of the population before the pandemic has run its course, an epidemiological parameter known as the attack rate, the total number of infected cases in a population at the end of an epidemic divided by the total population. For SARS-1, the attack rate was infinitesimal, with only a tiny fraction of the planet infected by the end of the pandemic, since 8,422 people out of 6.314 billion is just 0.00013%. For SARS-2, however, probably at least 40% of the human population worldwide will be infected in the end, and perhaps as much as 60%. Just as these epidemiological parameters help us compare SARS-2 to other coronaviruses, they can also help us learn from respiratory disease pandemics caused by other species of virus, such as the influenza virus. For nearly 30 years, I've been teaching about the decline in mortality in the United States during the 20th century. This decline had many causes, including the rise in wealth in our society, changes in behavior and public health practice, like sanitation and vaccination, and the emergence of modern medicine, though, as we will see in Chapter 3, medical interventions have played a smaller role than one might think. Regardless of the reason for it, however, when we look at the curve of overall death rates in our society in the 20th century, mortality drops and drops and drops across time, with only occasional small upward blips resisting our progress. But on the graph in Figure 8 of your PDF, there is an enormous spike of death in 1918. I always highlighted this outlier spike to my students. This is the so-called Spanish flu pandemic. My students treated it as an odd curiosity, and I spoke of it as a relic safely in the past, the way a parent might talk about how an adult child had survived leukemia as a toddler. But it was foolish to imagine that such a thing could not happen again. It's not surprising, of course, that few people other than historians and epidemiologists remember the details of the 1918 influenza pandemic, the deadliest plague of the past century. But most people I have spoken with since the SARS-2 pandemic began, including those old enough to have been around, do not remember the influenza pandemics of 1957 or 1968 either. I was six in 1968, so that is my excuse. I do, however, remember the 1976 swine flu pandemic that never materialized, despite its being widely anticipated. Mostly, I remember it because of the fact that the vaccine that was released to deal with it caused a serious but reversible neurological condition, Guillain-Barré syndrome, in one out of every 100,000 people, and one of my teachers at the Harvard School of Public Health wrote a book about the topic that I read in 1987. I also well remember the H1N1 pandemic of 2009, another swine flu, this one originating in Mexico, since by that time I was a professor at Harvard Medical School and I conducted research regarding the outbreak. Even though the 2009 pandemic is recent, most people overlook it simply because it was so mild and not many people died, so it gets no respect either. As someone who has studied all of the flu outbreaks that occurred in the past century, I naturally used them as points of reference as COVID-19 began to gain steam. In February 2020, as preliminary estimates about the CFR and R0 for SARS-2 started streaming in from China, I became increasingly convinced that the pandemic that COVID-19 would most resemble was the 1957 influenza pandemic. I knew that it would not be mild, like the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, and I feared, but doubted, that it would be like 1918. At the time, I was teaching a public health class at Yale. At the beginning of the semester, in January, when I was not yet paying attention to the butterfly flapping its wings in China, I had given my usual lecture to the students about the aberrancy that the 1918 pandemic had caused in the curve plotting the steady decline in mortality during the 20th century. I did not expect that within 2 months we would face a real risk of another such spike. On March 5, 2020, I gave a lecture about COVID-19 and its likely severity. The students were leaving for spring break the next day, and as I looked out over the sea of inquisitive and happy faces, I tried to be both hopeful and matter-of-fact. I feared they might not be allowed to return to campus, as the pandemic was likely to get worse during their break, and I was right. In order to benchmark myself, I used a classic approach. I assembled a sample of respiratory pandemics from the 20th century and graphed them on a chart using two numbers, the CFR, which indexed the severity of the disease, and the R0, which indexed the transmissibility, as shown in Figure 9 of your PDF. Doing this really focused my attention. I used estimates of these parameters that had emerged from China in February, and it seemed to me that SARS-2 had intermediate lethality and intermediate transmissibility, making it at least as bad as the influenza pandemic of 1957. Ultimately, 115,700 excess deaths occurred in the United States over 3 years due to the 1957 pandemic. That year, the population size of the country was 172 million, and cancer killed 255,000 people. This would be equivalent to roughly 300,000 Americans dying from COVID-19 by the end of the pandemic, a figure we are sure to surpass despite our extensive shutdowns. To be clear, the influenza virus that caused the 1957 pandemic is totally different from the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Both are riboviruses, meaning that they use RNA rather than DNA for their genetic code, but that is a very broad classification. It's sort of like saying that dolphins and elephants are both mammals. The two types of viruses come from very different branches of the genetic tree, from different phyla. There are four broad types of influenza virus, labeled A, B, C, and D. Influenza pandemics result from the emergence of viral strains that are novel, often from genetic recombination in animal reservoirs, usually birds or pigs. The 1957 pandemic was caused by influenza A, and it was of the H2N2 subtype. Influenza A viruses are further divided into subtypes based on two proteins on their surfaces, hemagglutinin, H, and neuraminidase, N. There are 18 different kinds of hemagglutinin, labeled H1 to H18, and 11 different kinds of neuraminidase, N1 to N11. While this in principle potentially yields 198 different combinations, only 131 subtypes have been detected naturally. The types of influenza that currently routinely circulate in our species and cause the familiar seasonal influenza include the A, H3N2, and A, H5N1 subtypes. Virus species causing outbreaks can be genetically different, but still express the same protein types on their surface. The 1957 pandemic likely started in central China, and it became known to the rest of the world in April of 1957. Globally, it killed 1.1 million people. But there was great regional variation. For instance, there were 0.3 deaths per 10,000 people in Egypt and 9.8 deaths per 10,000 people in Chile. This variation across locations, which is common in respiratory pandemics, is sometimes perplexing. In 1957, the wealth of a country and its latitude explained 43% of the variation in excess mortality from the flu pandemic. The way people in a particular area live, from population density to household size to the timing of school openings, may also play a role. It's possible that prior exposures to similar pathogens may confer some immunity in certain areas, and the chance occurrence of an early superspreading event may affect outcomes. But overall, annoyingly and often, we are unable to account for why some parts of the world or some parts of a country are more stricken than other parts. A lot of the time, it's just a matter of luck. The first rumblings of the 1957 pandemic in the United States were in a tiny article, fewer than 150 words, in the New York Times on April 17, 1957, Hong Kong Battles Influenza Epidemic. It noted that 250,000 people in Hong Kong were afflicted, 10% of the city's population. The pandemic touched down in the United States 6 weeks later on June 2nd, in a group of military personnel aboard destroyers in Newport, Rhode Island. But other outbreaks, unconnected to Rhode Island, soon occurred in California. The first began on June 20th at a camp for teenage girls in Davis. Over the next few weeks, there were more than 15 similar outbreaks in children's camps throughout the state. And then, in late June, there was a convention involving 1,800 young people from 43 states and several foreign countries held in Grinnell, Iowa. Several of the people attending this event had been in contact with prior cases in California. About 200 people got sick at the conference, and another 50 cases emerged after attendees had returned home. And yet, the International Boy Scout Jamboree was held in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, from July 10th to July 24th, with hardly any problems. Only a few sporadic cases were noted, despite more than 53,000 boys and personnel from all parts of the world gathering there. All of this was carefully traced later on by a team of epidemiologists who published a paper in 1961 with a hand-drawn map showing the movements of infected people in bold black arrows. It looked like a map of military operations from World War II. The pandemic waned a bit later in the summer, but it recurred when schools opened in the fall. By September, it was everywhere in the United States, and there was a peak in excess deaths in October. By December 16, 1957, the first wave had almost entirely subsided. However, there were subsequent waves of the pandemic, as is typical, with another peak in excess deaths in February of 1958, and then again in April of 1959. Waves of cases and peaks of deaths have to do with many factors. Respiratory diseases are influenced by the weather. For example, the regular, non-pandemic flu has a baseline seasonality. Roughly 6% of all deaths are caused by pneumonia and influenza in the summer, and 8% of all deaths are caused by them in the winter. Typically, these respiratory viruses travel between the northern and southern hemispheres, affecting whichever is in winter. In the summer, the relative heat and humidity may affect how long the virus survives outside our bodies, or possibly how well our bodies can resist it. But in addition to temperature, the rhythm of work and school life changes seasonally. In the winter, people are indoors and are more densely packed. All of these reasons can cause the effective reproduction number of a pathogen to decline in the summer to some extent. When this happens, in a process known as seasonal forcing, there can be an accumulation of susceptible individuals during the period of reduced transmission. People who would have gotten sick do not, and they pile up for the winter. Like a dam, the weather and the host behavior hold the epidemic back. But eventually, the dam breaks. This results in recurrent outbreaks and, ultimately, a seasonal pattern after the initial introduction of the pathogen. The pattern of school-aged children and working adults being infected but recovering, and very young and very old people dying, is a general phenomenon. The virus spreads among people who are out and about at school and work. It is then brought home, where it kills the age extremes, infants and the elderly, who are at the end of the transmission chains. This is also the reason, incidentally, that immunizing the elderly, while it will reduce their deaths, does not have much effect on the actual course of the epidemic. Immunizing working-age people helps break chains of transmission through social networks and can be much more effective in preventing deaths on a population level, an idea that resembles what we discussed earlier with respect to targeting socially connected people for immunization. It's important to note that, by the end of the 1957 pandemic, not everyone had been infected. The overall attack rate in the United States appears to have been about 24%, though this varied from place to place. It was as high as 41% in part of Louisiana. The 1957 pandemic ended after 3 years, when enough people had become immune that the population acquired herd immunity. In part, this was achieved through widespread vaccination. Flu vaccines were invented in 1945. Possibly the virus also became less virulent over time, which is another typical feature of infectious diseases. The 1918 flu pandemic, incorrectly labeled as originating in Spain, affected and killed many more people than the 1957 pandemic. Perhaps 39 million people died worldwide, which was 2.1% of the world population, and some experts put the worldwide toll as high as 100 million, given possible misidentification of deaths and poor reporting. Life expectancy was still low in the United States at the time. For men in 1915, it was 52.5 years, for women, 56.8, and infectious disease was still a major cause of death. But even so, the 1918 flu had a powerful adverse impact. The United States had a cumulative death rate of 0.52% of the population, or 550,000 people, including one in every 100 men between the ages of 25 and 34. Again, some estimates are higher. For comparison, in the United States in 2020, that would translate to 1,721,000 deaths. The impact of the pandemic was so substantial that, for a while, it even had an effect on the total average life expectancy in the United States, shaving off 10 years. As we saw in Figure 7, it really interrupted the trajectory of improving mortality in the nation. The fatality rate of the 1918 flu varied from country to country and place to place. For example, in Bristol Bay, Alaska, it was as high as 40%. But on the other end, it ranged from 1.6% in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, to 3% in Zamora, Spain, to 6% in Gujarat, India, to 10% in Siskiyou, South Africa. Some of this had to do with differing public health responses within and across countries. For instance, Korea was an outlier in 1918, as it is now. One policeman in Tokyo wistfully observed that the authorities in Korea had banned all mass gatherings, but we can't do this in Japan. Given how deadly this pandemic was, it's surprising that it's not more salient in our collective memory outside of public health circles. Everyone learns facts about World War I, but few learn much about the pandemic, which was much deadlier. Perhaps that's because dying of an illness at home seems less dramatic than dying in the trenches. But death from influenza in 1918 was totally horrific. People gasped for breath as their lungs filled with bloody fluid. Symptoms often started with two telltale mahogany spots on the cheeks that very quickly darkened the whole face, known as heliotrope cyanosis. The illness progressed from dusky reddish plum coloring on the skin to blue coloring and finally to black, spreading from feet and fingers to the whole body. The patient's chest and abdomen became distended. Some of the patients died rapidly and directly from the virus, but more often it was the secondary bacterial pneumonia that killed them. In short, it was nothing like the ridiculously glamorous death from the Spanish flu shown in an episode of Downton Abbey. The origin of the 1918 pandemic is not clear, but we know it was an H1N1 type of influenza. Reports from the time indicated that there were often simultaneous outbreaks in humans and pigs, but it's unclear which species gave it to which. The natural reservoir for influenza viruses is thought to be wild waterfowl, but humans are not often susceptible to catching the disease directly from birds. Since pigs can be infected with both bird and human strains of flu, it is suspected that they are often integral to the process whereby a virus becomes capable of infecting humans, which is why we intermittently call flu pandemics bird flu or swine flu. From time to time, there's a mixture of genetic material from these avian strains with existing human or pig strains, and, in a Frankenstein fashion, this leads to the creation of a new variety of the virus, which can then cause major or, depending on the mutations, minor outbreaks. Over the past 20 years, a kind of genetic archaeology has allowed us to learn more about what happened in 1918. Preserved tissue specimens from the lungs of two American soldiers who died in September 1918, one in New York and one in South Carolina, and a very precious sample from an Inuit woman who had been buried in the permafrost since November 1918, have allowed us to reconstruct the complete gene sequence of the virus and even bring it back to life in a secure laboratory at the CDC to better understand these mutations and their physiological and epidemiological implications. The first wave of the pandemic occurred in the spring and summer of 1918. The virus was highly contagious, but it caused relatively few deaths. For reasons that are not entirely clear, in August of that year, a much more lethal and infectious form of the disease emerged and spread worldwide. In the United States, the main impact was felt between September and November 1918, and in some American cities, many thousands of people per week died. There were three primary waves of the pandemic: a peak in the spring of 1918, a rapid second wave in the fall of 1918, peaking in October, and a third wave a year later in the winter of 1919. It finally subsided that summer, as shown in Figure 10 of your PDF. There is some evidence that the disease first crossed from pigs to humans in Kansas, afflicting a mess cook at Camp Funston, a U.S. Army training facility, on March 4, 1918. From there, it spread with troop movements to the East Coast and then to France by April. This resulted in the pandemic causing significant military disruption in Europe. While the morbidity was highest in the U.S. Army, 26%, with over 1 million men sickened in 1918, the German Army reported 700,000 cases, and the British Expeditionary Forces reported 313,000 cases in France. Perhaps half of the British forces were afflicted. In August 1918, the flu erupted again in three locations: Boston, arriving there from European ships; Brest, France, via troop movements; and Freetown, Sierra Leone, via British naval vessel. From these points and others, it spread throughout the United States and the whole world. Most of the deaths occurred in the period between September and December 1918. The disease was devastating. For example, in early September 1918, Dr. Victor Vaughn, acting Surgeon General of the Army, received urgent orders to go to Camp Devens near Boston. When he arrived, he was stunned. "I saw hundreds of young stalwart men in uniform coming into the wards of the hospital. Every bed was full, yet others crowded in. The faces wore a bluish cast. A cough brought up the blood-stained sputum. In the morning, the dead bodies are stacked about the morgue like cordwood." On the day he arrived, 63 men died from influenza. A detailed study from Norway, where partial data on the socioeconomic status of victims was available, showed that the first wave hit the poor but the second wave hit the rich. It afflicted world leaders, including President Woodrow Wilson, French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau, and UK Prime Minister David Lloyd George. Some authorities believe that the flu even hastened the end of World War I. This second wave in the United States ended very abruptly. For example, after peaking in New York City on October 20, 1918, the flu all but disappeared from the metropolis by November 24. There are many theories about why the second wave was worse. One is that it struck an already weakened population, even more worn out by war and famine. It also may have been related to how the particular circumstances of the war favored the evolution of a deadlier strain of the virus. Ordinarily, pathogens evolve to be less deadly since it does not suit their interests to kill their hosts. A dead host cannot easily spread the germ to others, so causing milder illness is better for the pathogen from a Darwinian point of view. People who are very sick stay home in bed or die, and those who are only mildly sick continue with their lives, preferentially spreading milder strains of the pathogen. But in the trenches of World War I, the process was reversed. Soldiers with a mild strain stayed put on the battlefield or wherever they were, often dying of other causes, while patients who were seriously ill or near death were transported to crowded hospitals, often on crowded trains. Thus, it's possible the deadlier strains of the virus could have been advantaged, spreading to more people. Philadelphia was among the hardest-hit American cities, along with other densely populated industrial cities such as Pittsburgh, Lowell, and Chicago. The initial wave of the flu came to Philadelphia on a British merchant ship. The health director of the city, a gynecologist named Wilmer Cruzan, had to decide whether to shut down the city entirely or take more limited measures. The problem was that a parade in support of the war effort was planned for September 28, 1918, not dissimilar to the large meeting of the Chinese Communist Party in Wuhan in 2020. It was not canceled, and an estimated 200,000 people, over one-tenth of the population of the city, attended. The Philadelphia Liberty Loans Parade was 2 miles long and even had a marching band led by John Philip Sousa. Within 2 days, hospital capacity in the city was exceeded. Shortly thereafter, by October 3rd, the epidemic took off like wildfire. People died so fast that caskets piled up in the streets, and volunteers had to dig mass graves. It has been called the deadliest parade in American history. In New York, the epidemic also arrived by sea. On August 11, 1918, the Norwegian vessel Bergensfjord radioed ahead to say that 10 of its passengers and 11 of its crew were ill. The ship was met in Brooklyn the day it arrived. The patients were brought to nearby hospitals, and the ship was placed under quarantine. But the epidemic still took hold in New York City and spread fast. At its peak, on October 20, 1918, over 800 people died from influenza and pneumonia combined. This death count at the peak of the second wave was not dissimilar to the first wave of COVID-19 in New York City in 2020, but the city was less than a third the size back then. More than 30,000 people died in New York City by the end of the 1918 pandemic. In response to the influenza pandemic, New York City took advantage of what was a very sophisticated public health system for its time, honed in part by years of experience dealing with other infectious diseases, such as tuberculosis, yellow fever, and diphtheria. The city staggered business hours to avoid rush hour crowding and established over 150 health centers to manage disease surveillance and coordinate care for patients in mostly voluntary home-based isolation. Then, as now, officials struggled with whether to close the schools, theaters, and subways. The health commissioner, Royal S. Copeland, a homeopathic physician and later a U.S. senator, generally favored keeping things open, but the sick were strictly quarantined at their homes or at special institutions. Most patients were not infectious prior to the onset of symptoms, which meant that such isolation could be employed as a means of disease control. Masks were encouraged. Sharing cups at drinking fountains was discouraged. And there was a massive public health education campaign, thousands of placards and millions of leaflets written in English, Italian, German, and Yiddish, told citizens to cover their mouths and noses and stop spitting in public. An anti-spitting campaign had been started 20 years earlier, but it was stepped up during the pandemic. Signs throughout the city carried messages such as, "Spit spreads death." Public funerals were banned. Only spouses were allowed. Copeland famously did not close the schools on the grounds that homes were more dangerous. His rationale was, New York is a great cosmopolitan city, and in some homes, there is careless disregard for modern sanitation. In the schools, the children are under the constant guardianship of the medical inspectors. This work is part of our system of disease control. If the schools were closed, at least 1 million would be sent to their homes and become 1 million possibilities for the disease. Furthermore, there would be nobody to take special notice of their condition. Dr. S. Josephine Baker, the progressive head of child hygiene, argued for keeping children in school where they could minimize exposure to unhygienic home situations and receive food and care if sick. The schools were also viewed as a conduit to get health information to families. Copeland endured enormous criticism, but the strategy was vindicated by the results. Public health decisions always involve difficult utilitarian trade-offs between benefits and costs to different people. New York City ended up keeping quarantine measures in place for 73 days, and it began to quarantine relatively early compared to other cities, such as Philadelphia, roughly 2 weeks earlier in the course of its epidemic. Consequently, in the end, New York City had approximately half the excess deaths that Philadelphia had. Quantifying excess deaths is a statistical technique often employed by modern scholars studying epidemics, but it was first proposed by a founder of epidemiology, William Farr, in London in 1847. Farr defined this quantity as the number of deaths observed during an epidemic in excess of those expected under normal circumstances. This approach is especially appropriate when quantifying historical epidemics, which may have had different definitions of disease or for which few records are available. The technique again found use in 2020 for the COVID-19 pandemic, given the fog of war in knowing accurately how many people are actually dying of the disease. By tracking excess deaths overall, or for a specific category of causes of death, such as pneumonia and influenza, it is possible to detect a spike in cases in the United States in late February and early March, even before COVID-19 was widely recognized as a problem. This helps quantify possible underreporting due to misdiagnosed or overlooked cases. For instance, an analysis of national data from early January 2020 through March 28, 2020, by scientists at Yale found that California reported 101 deaths due to COVID-19 during this period, but there were actually 399 excess deaths due to pneumonia and influenza. Many or most of those deaths were surely from COVID-19. Looking at all causes of death combined in New York and New Jersey in this same period, the investigators found that there was as much as a threefold increase in total deaths as the pandemic swept through those two states during its first wave, regardless of how many cases of COVID-19 were actually diagnosed by healthcare personnel. And looking at the entire United States through the end of May 2020, researchers concluded that the reported number of COVID-19 deaths was likely 22% lower than the true number of deaths. Finally, the quantification of excess deaths allows us to summarize the overall impact of the pandemic on people's health. The virus kills some people directly by infecting them and others indirectly by, for example, prompting people to delay going to the hospital for other conditions and thus needlessly dying, or by increasing suicides as a result of depression due to job loss or social isolation. But the pandemic also saved some lives, too. For instance, motor vehicle fatalities fell during the winter and spring of 2020 as fewer people were on the road. There were fewer deaths due to complications from non-critical medical procedures, as hospitals had canceled elective procedures. Fewer babies were born premature, possibly because their homebound mothers were under less physical stress and were less exposed to all pathogens. And fewer people lost their lives to respiratory conditions as air pollution was reduced due to the cessation of manufacturing activity. The emergence of pandemics is not restricted to the 20th century or to respiratory illnesses caused by coronavirus or influenza, of course. Dramatic outbreaks of infectious diseases have afflicted human beings for a long time. Pathogens are just as important to our species as the predators we faced in our distant evolutionary past. And infectious diseases, like other major forces, from the invention of agriculture in cities to the occurrence of economic crises and wars, have shaped our societies in our historical past. The original plague referred to a particular condition, namely bubonic plague. This condition has what historian Frank Snowden has called four protagonists. First, there is the causative bacterium itself, Yersinia pestis. Then, there is the flea by which it moves. Then, there is the rat that transports the fleas and that serves as a host. And finally, there are the unfortunate humans who, like the rats, are wiped out by the pathogen. The bacteria move from one animal to another animal and from one species to another species, for example, from rats to us, through the exchange of fleas. The plague is therefore best understood as a disease that primarily affects wild rodents and only accidentally affects us. In this regard, it resembles the other zoonotic, meaning originating in animals, pathogens we have been considering. Because the plague also afflicted the rats, they also died horrible deaths, typically just before the humans. In medieval Europe, it was often noted that they would come above ground looking for water and then die in the streets in what are called rat falls. Rats frequently appear in paintings of plague scenes for this reason. They are an evil omen. And once a flea carrying Yersinia hops from a rat to a human, the pathogen can spread like wildfire. Close physical contact between humans allows fleas to spread directly from person to person. In a deep irony, fleas have evolved to find hosts in part by detecting the warmth of their bodies. Therefore, once their host died and the corpse turned cold, the fleas began leaping away to find a new host. Often this meant they landed on people tending to the body of recently deceased loved ones. In contrast to other infectious diseases that typically afflict the very young and the very old, plague killed indiscriminately. And another of the special qualities of bubonic plague was the extraordinarily high level of fatality and the speed with which it killed. Every time the plague came, the force of death was so great that contemporary observers spoke of how all of humanity might be annihilated. The plague caused very gruesome deaths that were often painful and dehumanizing, with visible manifestations on the body. People dying of the plague were said to have a foul odor. Certain accounts even suggested, to my amazement, that it was the stench that drove caregivers away more than the fear of contracting the disease. The pathogen would travel to lymph nodes and cause painful swellings called buboes, from which we get the adjective bubonic. Here is how Michael of Piazza described the Black Death during an outbreak in Messina in 1347. The burn blisters appeared, and boils developed in different parts of the body, on the sexual organs, and others on the thighs, or on the arms, and in others on the neck. At first, these were the size of the hazelnut, and the patient was seized by violent shivering fits, which soon rendered him so weak that he could no longer stand upright, but he was forced to lie on his bed, consumed by a violent fever and overcome by great tribulation. Soon the boils grew to the size of a walnut, then to that of a hen's egg or a goose's egg, and they were exceedingly painful and irritated the body, causing it to vomit blood by vitiating the juices. The blood rose from the affected lungs to the throat, producing a putrefying and ultimately decomposing effect on the whole body. The sickness lasted 3 days, and on the fourth, at the latest, the patient succumbed. Most infectious diseases do not want to kill us because it hinders their ability to spread. So why was the plague so deadly? The explanation relies on the presence of a third party, the flea. The germ could not ordinarily spread from one person to another on its own. In order for it to get from one host to another, it first had to be consumed by a flea and wind up in the flea's body. However, a flea, even when it has a big meal, ingests only a tiny amount of blood. For the microbes to spread, they had to be pervasive enough in human blood so that even that tiny flea meal had enough of the pathogen to infect the next host. This means that the bacteria had to grow fast and overwhelm the body quickly so that there would be enough bacteria to actually make it into the flea. And so the bacteria evolved to create enormous levels of bacteremia, the presence of bacteria circulating in the bloodstream, also known as sepsis, with as many as 100 million germs per cubic milliliter of human blood. However, in some circumstances, it was possible for Yersinia to spread directly from person to person without the necessity of fleas. This was one of the most feared and deadly forms of plague, called pneumonic plague. Here, the bacteria found their way into the secretions of a person's lungs, so if he or she coughed or sneezed, droplets would go from that person's respiratory system into the respiratory system of another. As a result, outbreaks did not depend on either rats or fleas. This may help explain perplexing outbreaks of plague in environments where those creatures could not easily thrive, such as in Northern Europe. The bubonic plague is estimated to have killed around 200 million people over the 1,400 years it has ravaged worldwide populations, primarily in three major pandemics beginning in the 6th, 14th, and 19th centuries. Across a variety of sites, archaeologists have found little evidence for variation in plague mortality related to demographic or health attributes. The bubonic plague spared no one. The first of these pandemics, known as the Plague of Justinian, started in 541 CE, and it had 18 successive waves before it ended in 755 CE. It is thought to have originated in Africa. The reasons it stopped are not well understood, and more recent historical, archaeological, and epidemiological evidence suggests that, though severe, the Justinian plague was not as disruptive of Mediterranean or European history as previously thought. The second plague, one of the most catastrophic pandemics ever, began in Central Asia and reached Europe in 1347. It lasted on and off for nearly 500 years, then disappeared in the 1830s. The last epidemic of plague in England occurred in 1665, but there was a substantial outbreak in Italy in 1743. The first wave of the second plague, which lasted from 1347 to 1353, is what we think of as the Black Death, although that term was not used at the time. During this first wave, driven by a favorable environment of densely packed towns and cities and substantial poverty, as much as half of the population of Europe was wiped out. This force was so powerful that it even acted as a selection pressure, changing the course of human evolution. As we will see in Chapter 8, many people may have genetic features today that reflect the fact that their ancestors were the ones who survived. Finally, in 1870, there was the third occurrence, largely in India, in what is known as the modern plague. That epidemic caused between 13 and 15 million deaths, primarily in Mumbai, between 1898 and 1910. In the 20th century in the United States, the CDC estimates that there were just over 1,000 cases of plague between 1900 and 2016, concentrated mostly in the Southwest and California, largely among hunters and others exposed to wild animals. We do not really even think of it as a plague anymore. We just call it a Yersinia infection, and it can be cured in a straightforward fashion with streptomycin or tetracycline, standard antibiotics in a doctor's toolkit. Doctors in medieval Europe were at special risk during the plague, as healthcare workers always are in epidemics. But so were a hodgepodge of people in other professions, such as priests, gravediggers, bakers, because the storage of grain attracted rats, and even street vendors. As I stumbled on this list of risky occupations for the plague, I could not help but notice the analogy to our predicament in 2020. Essential workers who sell us food always seem to be at risk. Ships were also a locus of risk, and at sea there was no escape. Sometimes the plague would take so many lives that a ship would drift on the water untended, all of its passengers and crew dead. The same had happened during the plague of Justinian. One ancient account noted ships in the midst of the sea whose sailors were suddenly attacked by God's wrath, and the ships became tombs for their captains, and they continued adrift on the waves carrying the corpses of their owners. This too, albeit with greater destruction back then, anticipated the coronavirus-afflicted cruise ships of 2020. In his famous book, A Journal of the Plague Year, written in 1722, Daniel Defoe noted that the danger of immediate death to ourselves took away all bonds of love, all concerns for one another. People were often abandoned to die alone. The sudden death that plague brought posed religious problems to societies so dependent on clerical absolution. The inability to prepare for death, to atone for sins, and to have last rites were seen as particular indignities. Of course, people everywhere want to have a chance to prepare for death, and one study my lab did found that 84% of Americans thought that feeling prepared to die was very important at the end of life. Little has changed when it comes to outbreaks of serious infectious diseases. Plague in medieval Europe also repeatedly gave rise to episodes of scapegoating and witch-burning. And from the same impetus of fear, it prompted religious revivals as people sought to pacify an angry god. Ironically, even though the emergence of modern nation-states, which are characterized by urban living and far-flung trade, contributed to the enormity of the outbreaks of infectious diseases, those same factors also equipped humans with tools to respond. For instance, in the 15th century, the Office of Health in Venice constructed facilities on outlying islands where all arriving ships had to sequester for 40 days, which is the origin of the term quarantine, based on the Italian word for 40, quaranta. This duration had its foundation in the Bible, which frequently refers to the number 40 in the context of purification, such as the 40 days and nights that the flood in Genesis lasted, the 40 days that Moses spent on Mount Sinai before receiving the Ten Commandments, the 40 days of Christ's temptation, and the 40 days of Lent. For overland travelers, however, quarantine was much more difficult to enforce. Efforts to do so gave rise to the cordon sanitaire, a ribbon of forts and military outposts interspersed along a border and patrolled by troops in an attempt to prevent the movement of contaminated goods and people. Outsiders were denied entry or were subject to quarantine. There was clearly some recognition, if not full understanding, that cases could be imported from elsewhere. Some Genoese, whom the disease had forced to flee, crossed the Alps in search of a safe place to live, and so came to Lombardy. Some had merchandise with them and sold it while they were staying in Bobbio, whereupon the purchaser, their host, and his whole household, together with several neighbors, were infected and died suddenly of the disease. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, such a cordon, built by the Austro-Hungarian Empire and reinforced when outbreaks were known to be happening, stretched over 1,000 miles from the Adriatic Sea to the Alps. These actions suggest that epidemics have deeply concerned our predecessors and motivated enormous efforts at control. The scale of mortality of the plague is truly difficult to comprehend. As noted earlier, it is estimated that 30 to 50% of the entire European population died in a 5-year period during the first wave from 1347 to 1351. In some locations, whole villages and populations were wiped out completely. It is estimated that 60% of the population of both Florence and Siena died. So many people died so fast that the workers digging the mass graves could not keep up. Here is how Baldassare Bonaiuti, a Florentine historian, described it in 1348. At every church, or at most of them, they dug deep trenches down to the waterline, wide and deep, depending on how large the parish was. And those who were responsible for the dead carried them on their backs in the night in which they died and threw them into the ditch, or else they paid a high price to those who would do it for them. The next morning, if there were many bodies in the trench, they covered them over with dirt, and then more bodies were put on top of them, with a little more dirt over those. They put layer on layer, just like one puts layers of cheese in a lasagna. And even after such devastation, the plague just kept returning. One of the theories as to why the plague eventually ended in Europe had little to do with the actions of the human protagonists. Instead, it had to do with competition among rats. In the early 18th century, a larger variety of rat, the brown rat, appears to have arrived in Europe and driven the native black rat from its former habitat. The brown rat was aggressive with its competing rat species, but it was fearful of humans and sought to avoid them. Another factor that is thought to have played a role was a particularly severe cold snap in 1650 that coincided with the end of the plague. As we have seen, epidemics depend on a complex interaction of pathogen, host, and environment. Many other plagues we have not considered have loomed large in their own times, from outbreaks of smallpox that afflicted Americans in the 17th and 18th centuries, to cholera and yellow fever in the 19th, to polio, syphilis, and HIV in the 20th. Still, pandemics on the scale of COVID-19 are rare. There is something about a threat that reoccurs at the dim reaches of living memory every 50 or 100 years that makes our species seem particularly small. When such a threat reappears, human suffering is combined with the sad realization that we should have seen it coming. Epidemics generally take advantage of the deepest and most highly evolved aspects of our humanity. We evolve to live in groups, to have friends, to touch and hug each other, and to bury and mourn one another. If we lived like hermits, we would not be victims of contagious disease. But the germs that kill us during times of plague often spread precisely because of who we are. And so for centuries, our response in a time of plague has been to rediscover the necessity of surrendering these aspects of our nature for a while. We forget the lessons of past pandemics for different reasons. In some cases, they are simply too far back in our collective memory or too obscured by other events. Those plagues have become objects of inquiry to small groups of academic historians or scientists, or they are subjects of oral traditions or myths. During Passover in early April 2020, several of my Jewish friends observed that biblical plagues had always been abstract for them, but now they felt more real. The point of the story at the Seder was more manifest. In other cases, the reasons for forgetting are more prosaic, more epidemiological, more related to numbers. The particular pandemic disease was not fatal enough, 2009 H1N1 influenza. Or it did not afflict enough people because it was not infectious enough, MERS. Or it burned out too fast, SARS-1. Or it afflicted a confined group of the human population, Ebola. Or it was brought low by a vaccine, measles and polio, or by treatment, HIV, or by eradication, smallpox, allowing most people to simply push the disease out of their minds. While the way we have come to live in the time of the COVID-19 pandemic might feel alien and unnatural, it is actually neither of those things. Plagues are a feature of the human experience. What happened in 2020 was not new to our species. It was just new to us.
Chapter 3. Pulling Apart. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress or egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world would take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons. There were improvisatori. There were ballet dancers. There were musicians. There was beauty. There was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. Edgar Allan Poe, The Mask of the Red Death, 1842. Though plagues have long been a part of the human experience, when the coronavirus gained its footing in early 2020, it met a scientific and medical environment wholly different from those of prior pandemics. Scientists can rapidly sequence the genome of the virus, which allows them to identify new variants of the virus and track its spread. We can invent and deploy genetic tests to quickly and accurately diagnose infection. We can track the flow of people around the globe using mobile phone data. We have ICUs and computerized ventilators that were not even imaginable in the past. We have whole new classes of antiviral drugs and a deep understanding of virus biology and pharmacology. And we can use the internet to share information instantly and widely. But how much did all of that really help us? We have not done much better at stopping a virus than our forebears did, and they had fewer resources. Despite all the advances in science and medicine in the past century, it's humbling and shocking to think how little things have changed. With our bans on public gatherings and our use of masks, it feels like a return to the primitive tools of an epidemiological stone age. And yet, familiar threats call for familiar measures. There are two broad ways to respond to an epidemic. The first is via pharmaceutical interventions, such as medications and vaccines, which scientists around the world are now racing to develop. On that front, we are certainly on better footing than those before us. For centuries, people have tried to treat disease with appalling concoctions that have no scientific basis, and almost without exception, they did not work. During the Black Death, the least dangerous treatments that unlucky souls were subjected to were rubbings with chopped onions or dead snakes if available. If that failed, self-flagellation, arsenic, and mercury were options. The last item might have even made some sense. In fact, in 1918, doctors noted a puzzling immunity to the flu in soldiers sick with syphilis who were being treated with mercury in a French venereal disease clinic. The notorious toxicity of the mercury, however, ensured that the cure was in some ways worse than the disease, an unfortunate refrain in the history of medicine. However, contrary to what many people think, medicine has actually played a surprisingly small role in the decline of most infectious diseases across time. One of the most powerful ways to illustrate this is to plot the rates of death for various infectious diseases starting in 1900. The rates drop at some point, and then there is a long, relatively flat line of low rates of death thereafter. It would seem reasonable to imagine that rates of measles deaths, for example, were high and then suddenly dropped after a measles vaccine was discovered and released in 1963. We might expect to see the same pattern in other infections, like scarlet fever, tuberculosis, typhoid, and diphtheria. But if you place an arrow above the year in which a specific vaccine or treatment for each of those conditions was invented, again and again, we see that the arrow actually winds up on the long, flat part of the curve, well after the initial descent, as shown in Figure 11 of your PDF. If you imagine a young child sledding down a steep hill, the vaccine or drug therapy for the disease would arrive during that long period of coasting on the level part of the sled run at the end. Plots like this were first propounded by the British physician and historian Thomas McEwen in 1966 in order to illustrate this very point, that modern medicine was not the primary force that caused infectious diseases to go away. The actual cause, McEwen argued, was socioeconomic improvements and the implementation of public health measures. For instance, the great rise in wealth worldwide during the past two centuries has increasingly afforded humans access to the clean water and safe food that technological and scientific advances have yielded. These advances, and also improvements in family planning and education,